You in Austin or San Antonio?
San Antonio.
And it's how's the weather here? It's what?
77.
Just tell you, I love that lady, and I love listening to her. So anyway, I appreciate her suggesting me. You may not appreciate it, but I do. Anyway, all right, let's get on with this so I can get it over with. That's always my favorite part, is to be done. So I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I do not have alcoholic parents. I do have two older sisters and an older brother. My oldest sister is 11 years older than me, and she has drank, smoked, taken a pill, done something since I can remember, since I was, you know, young. And she doesn't think she's an alcoholic, and she doesn't think she's has a problem, and she may not be an alcoholic. I don't know, but I can tell you she gives a good impression of one. And then I've got a sister that is 10 years older than me, and about 12 years ago, she went into the rooms of AA. And about 7 years later, she called me crying, and I answered the phone, and she said, and I said, "What's wrong?" And she goes, "I don't think I'm an alcoholic." And I go, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Because I really want to be." And I said, "What is going on?" And she said, "I've been back through the Big Book with my sponsor. I've been through the steps with my sponsor, and I feel like a fake and a fraud in those meetings, and I do not relate, and I just don't think I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "Well, why did you come to AA or go to AA in the first place?" And she said, "Well, if I'm being honest, I thought my husband would follow me into the rooms." And I said, "Welcome to Al-Anon." And then I have a brother that is 2 years older than me, and he has been in prison 3 times, and he's been in jail more times than I can count. And he, all of that is because of drugs and alcohol. And he died 2 years ago this past December, and he died the alcoholic death that they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a horrible, awful, miserable death. It just was. And he drank himself to death. He was 6 years older than me. He was 6'1". I'm sorry, he was 6'5", and he weighed 135 pounds when he died. And I've been trying to change my brother for the majority of his life. I've been trying to get him to do what I thought he should do as a brother, and to act the way that I thought he should act. And I did that most of my life. And thank God you people got to me before it was too late. And I had learned to love my brother for who he was and what he was, and I hadn't tried to change him in a long, long time. And I'm so grateful for you for that, because I learned who my brother was, and I learned what I needed to do and not needed to do. And the last words on this earth that my brother said was that he loved me. And I was there the last day he was here. I was with him. And so I'm really grateful for that. And I'm the youngest of all of us, and I am the baby, and I have never drank or done a drug in my whole entire life. And I can tell who the alcoholics are in the rooms because they just passed out. But I just never did. And I did that not because of these great scruples I have. Although I did grow up with really good morals and great principles in my life. My parents were really good about that. I knew right from wrong. I had good morals. I had a good upbringing. But I did that because I'd seen what happened to my brothers and sisters, and they always got in trouble and it seemed to always be related around drinking or doing some sort of drug, and they always got into trouble. So I just decided I was never going to do that. And what I know about that now is that that was my way of controlling. I thought if I never did a drug, if I never drank, I would not get in trouble. I would not be affected. Now, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about drug addiction. I didn't know anything about that, but that was my thought process when I was a really little girl. I mean, I remember making that decision, and I stuck to it. And like I said, I know that today that was all about control, all trying to see if I can control the stuff around me that I would be okay. I grew up in a little town, and we lived on 10 acres, and my dad was as old as everybody else's grandfather. He was in World War II. He grew up during the Depression. And we had a really good life. I mean, I'm just going to tell you, I had a good life. We lived in this little town. Everybody knew us. We knew everybody. And I was golden. And then I turned 7. And when I turned 7, my parents divorced. And when my parents divorced, my mom moved me to a suburb of Oklahoma City called Moore, Oklahoma. And I hated Moore. And if anybody's from Moore, knows anybody from Moore, I apologize right now. I just hated it. And the reason why I hated it is because I was used to living out in the country, where my closest neighbor was a mile and a half down the road. And now I'm living in this town where I could reach out and touch the house next door to me, it feels like. And kids were mean to me for the first time in school. I'd never had anybody tease me or be mean to me other than my brother, which is kind of his job. But kids were mean to me for the first time, and they called me names. And the reason why they were mean to me is because I was the ugliest kid in school. I'm going to tell you what I look like. I had buck teeth really, really bad. And I had these eye teeth that were coming out through my gums because my baby teeth wouldn't fall out. So I looked like a vampire bunny. I had this big nose. I got my nose fixed in my 20s. My doctor said, your nose would look better on a man. And I said, it does. It's my daddy's nose. And it looks great on him, but it's not perfection on me, I promise you. And so I had this big nose. I had these big, thick glasses because I could not see 3 feet in front of my face. And I was a tomboy. And so I was always in hand-me-down clothes. And those usually consisted of like t-shirts or sweatshirts and jeans or cutoffs and cowboy boots or tennis shoes, or mostly barefoot in the summer. And it wasn't really hygienic because I was a tomboy. And my mom wasn't around a lot to make me do anything. And my mom started going out to clubs as soon as my parents got a divorce. And I told you before, my mom is not an alcoholic, and she's not. And she wasn't going out to clubs to get wasted and to drink. She was going out to clubs looking for him. And I didn't know that then, but I know that now. And that's what she was doing. And she was on a mission to replace my dad. She needed another him. And so I was left at home alone a lot. And from the time I was 8 until I was 13, my mother would leave me home for days at a time. And I was a latchkey kid. So I would come home from school, let myself in, and I started learning how to take care of myself. And when those kids were mean to me and calling me names and doing all the mean, hateful things to me, what I did is I just decided that if you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And so I just didn't have friends growing up. And I don't say that to be dramatic or, oh, that poor thing. I just didn't. That was my choice, because I was, again, trying to control, thinking that if I didn't let anybody close to me, they can't hurt me, so I'm fine. My mom started going out. She would leave me for days at a time. She would leave on a Friday to go to work, and I may not hear again from her until Monday morning, when she'd call me and tell me to get up and get ready to go to school. And we had changed roles in our household. I became the parent. I learned how to take care of myself. I learned how to fix my own meals. I learned how to do laundry. I learned how to dust the house and clean up. And what I know now about that is I was doing what would be a pattern later on, which is, if I could fix everything, maybe she'd stay home. Maybe she'd be here. Maybe I'll get her approval. And like I said, not an alcoholic, but she was still looking for something outside of her to fix her. And so things were different at my daddy's house. I would go to my daddy's house on the weekend, and my daddy had this girlfriend I hated. And we always went to her house. Every time I went to my daddy's house, we went to her house. We had dinner over there. And then they always had some project going on. They were always fixing the fence or working on the tractor or working on some vehicle or retiling the floor or building on a room or re-roofing the house. I mean, it seemed like there was always something going on. They were just hardworking people. And I was just kind of there. That's how I felt. I just kind of felt I was there. And really what I know now is that, you know, my daddy had no idea what to do with a little girl at that age. I mean, I was so much younger than my other sisters, and he was so much older that I just don't think he really knew what to do with me. And so anyway, that's just kind of the way it was. And I loved my dad. I mean, I am a daddy's girl. I love being around my dad. I mean, it didn't matter what we were doing. As long as I was around him, I was good. But when I was 13, my dad married that woman, and my mom met my stepdad. And at 13, both my parents got remarried, and my stepdad became the parent in our household again. And I had to give up that role, which I was not really ready to relinquish, because I thought I was doing a pretty good job of it. But he thought that I should not have that role, and he took over as parent. And what I know now is that my mom could not parent me, and so she found somebody who could. And I'm going to tell you, he did a lot of good things for me. My stepdad did a lot of good things for me. He was really smart. And he got me braces, and he got me contacts, and he taught me what to do and not do, and how to act and not act, and what fork to use, and all those things that I would not have had a clue about. And he was really good to me. And like I said, he taught me a lot. And I need you to hear all that, because what happened with us is, when I turned 16, I caught him watching me take showers through the skylight of the bathroom. And I went and got my mom. It was 11:30 at night. And I went and got my mom. I'd already caught him one time up there. I'd heard him one time up there. Actually, a couple times before that, I'd heard him up there while I was taking a shower, because I always had to take my showers at night. And I went and got my mom, and I told her what was going on. And she came out of her room and heard him on the roof and heard him coming down, coming off the roof. And she asked him what he was doing up on the roof at 11:30 at night. And he said he was cleaning the gutters. And, you know, makes perfect sense to me. It's going to rain the night before, 11:30 at night, it's a perfect time to clean your gutters. I'm just saying. And look, I don't think my mama believed him, but I think she was so scared of losing him and losing her security that she didn't know what to do. And what I can tell you is that I got asked to leave that house and a couple of months later, and I had to go move in with my dad. Now, that was not a big deal to me, I got to tell you. It was a big deal that my mom never said anything and let that happen and allowed me and allowed that to go on and allowed me to leave that house to go live with my dad. Never said a word. But living with my dad was, you know, a dream of mine. I've always wanted to live with my dad. But the problem at that time was that my dad was dying of a kidney disease. It runs rampant in our family. It's just hereditary and there's nothing you can do about it. And he was on a dialysis machine 3 times a week and I knew he was dying. And so I did with my dad what I did with those kids. If you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And so I stayed really busy. I had a job working in a bank after school when I was 16 years old. I was active in some committees at school and I stayed really busy at school and I stayed really busy at work and I just stayed gone a lot. Because again, I think I'm in control. I think I can control the pain. And my thought was, if I spend too much time with my dad, I'm going to really get close to him. And then when he dies, it's going to hurt that much worse. So I'm just not going to spend time with him. And that's silly and stupid, I know, but at the time it made perfect sense. But I've had an issue with trying to control things my whole life. And so what happened was my senior year of high school, the actual week of my high school graduation, my dad got a kidney transplant and saved his life. And everything changed for us. I started spending time with my daddy and we did a lot of good things, a lot of fun things together. We had a house at the lake. And so we, on weekends and summers, we were always fishing and running trot lines and hanging out. And, you know, I learned more about my dad in those probably 2 or 3 years that I'd known about my dad my whole life. And we got really close and I turned 19 and I met a guy. And I met this guy in September. In November, he asked me to marry him. And we got married in March. And my daddy hated him. And he was not quiet about it either. And you know, and he tried to tell me I was too young to get married. I was 19. This guy was 27. He tried to tell me I didn't know what I was doing. I don't know about you guys at 19, but I knew everything. As a matter of fact, I not only knew everything at 19, I've pretty much known everything my whole life, which is another character defect that will follow me that you will soon see is a pattern. But I did. I thought I knew everything. And I'm going to tell you, I got married to this man and I instantly knew this is the biggest mistake of your life. What were you thinking? But I can't say that because I'm the good girl and I want to be right. And I always want to be right. And I never want to make mistakes. And I really, really hate being wrong. And I really hate apologizing. And so I just am never wrong. That's how you fix that. You don't have to apologize if you're never wrong. So you're just never wrong. So I was never wrong. So I stayed married to this guy because I do what I've been taught to do my whole life, which is you just work at it. You work hard, you put in enough work, you can make anything happen. And so that's what I did. I tried everything to make this marriage work and nothing was changing and I was miserable. So I had a little boy because, you know, let's have a baby because that's going to help. But I had this little boy and he became the only reason I came home at night. And after about 7 years of marriage, I was wanting a way out and I wanted a way out. And I'm really what I wanted is I wanted a way out and I wanted it to be all his fault. And I don't know where this comes from, but I have this thing in my head of these rules and the reasons why you can get a divorce. And there's only certain reasons why you can get a divorce. In case you're wondering, I can tell you what they are. Don't ask me where they come from. Don't ask me why I believed them, but this is what they are. They have to beat you. Well, he didn't do that. Well, they have to cheat on you. Well, he didn't do that. Well, he's got to be an alcoholic. And he wasn't. I'm kind of convinced to this day, had he been an alcoholic, we might still be married. I'm not sure. But anyway, not an alcoholic. So these are the only reasons for getting a divorce. Now, I'm going to tell you, I don't know where that list comes from, but that's the only thing that I have in my head. And there was a lot of other things that were going on in that marriage, but those, the biggies, those three biggies that I just announced were not them. And so I'm looking for a way out of my marriage, and I don't know what to do. And it's been, and I've been in, like I said, we've been married 7 years. And by this time where I'm living back out in the country and I'm driving an hour into the city every day to work, and I work at a bank again. And one day, the way out of my marriage walked through the door. He was the best looking thing I've ever seen. Oh my gosh. He was 5'6". I don't know what it is. I love short guys. If you're alcoholic and short, I'm going to absolutely love you. But anyway, he's 5'6". He had dark brown hair. He had baby blue eyes. He had this great smile, nice tan, and he dressed to the nines. He was the attorney for the bank. He was on my loan approval committee. He was on my board of directors. And every time he walked in the bank, all the girls would bat their eyes and smile and giggle, and all the guys would shake his hand and pat him on the back. And I would kind of hide because I could not form a sentence around him. And that has not happened before or since, by the way, but I couldn't. And I was just a nervous wreck around him. And one day he asked me to bring a file down to his office that I was working on. And he took me to lunch, and that was it. I started dating him and I left my husband. And you need to hear that, because that's the order it came in. And it's not something I recommend. And it's absolutely not something I'm proud of, but that is exactly what I did. And I'm going to tell you, I hurt a lot of people by doing that, because selfishness and self-centeredness does not just come from the alcoholic. I will just tell you, they do not have the market cornered on that. And I acted out of selfishness and self-centered. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And I started dating him and I left my husband. And when people would ask me about that or would suggest something about that, I'm going to tell you, here was my answers. I would say, we were separated long before I started dating him. And we were separated. I was in the kitchen and he was in the garage. We were separated. Or I would say, oh, our marriage was over long before I started dating him. And our marriage was over. The problem was my husband didn't know that our marriage was over, but I had known it for a while. I just did not share the information with him. But that's the kind of stuff that I say, because I can't be wrong. I don't make mistakes. And I've got to look good. And so that's what I would say to people. And, you know, and I know now, because I've done some inventory and I've done some work on that, and I have a sponsor. So I now know that those were just lies. That's all that was. That was just lies. It just made it sound a little better, but I just lied. Anyway, so I start dating this guy and he is crazy. He is nothing like my first husband. My first husband was calm and mild and kind of laid back. And this guy is wild. And I had never been around anybody like him. I mean, he is wild. And he will say or do anything and embarrass me to death, but we are having fun. I'm just going to tell you. I'm telling you, you couldn't have gotten any more different than these two guys. I mean, it was like being married to a minister and now dating Satan. And so Satan and I are going out and having a lot of time, a lot of good fun, but I realized he didn't sleep very well for like days at a time. And then he sleeps for like days at a time. And I ask him about that, because I've never known anybody to be able to stay awake for days at a time. And he said, I have a sleeping disorder. I've had it since college. And I don't know what happens if you get information like that, but when I get information like that, my first thought is, we got to fix you. And that's what I set out to do. I am now going to solve your problem for you. Not that he asked, but I'm going to solve your problem for you. And so I start inquiring about this and I start asking him questions, and he says he's been to doctors and he's been to sleep studies and they can't figure it out. Well, obviously you are not doing something right and you're not going to the right doctors, and I am here to save you. Thank you very much. And so I start inquiring and I start asking him questions and I start looking into this. And the more that I inquire and ask, the more he gets a little irritated with me. And I can't figure out what's going on. And I know I'm missing something. I don't know what it is. So I did what anybody would do in that situation. I move in with him, because you got to watch him 24/7, because I'm pretty sure he's having too much caffeine intake. I'm pretty sure that's too much screen time. There's something going on there. I'm going to figure it out. So I move in with him. And then I start watching him and I start asking. And again, I'm inquiring minds. And the more that I would investigate and the more that I would question, we started having arguments. We started having fights. And at first it was no big deal. It was just these little, you know, bickering and whatever. And I'd get mad and he'd come back and apologize and it'd be okay. And they just kept happening more regularly and more frequently. And it kind of coincided with the more questions I asked and the more that I wanted to know what was going on. And one day we got in a huge fight and I left, and I had kept my apartment and I'd been gone for a couple of weeks, and he called me and he said, you know what I think we should do? And I said, what? He said, I think we should go see a counselor. And I thought that was a great idea. Now, let me just say this. I'd never been to a counselor before in my life. I didn't even really know anything about counseling, but I thought that was a great idea. And so he made an appointment for us. And the lady wanted to see me by myself first, which was fine. And I went to go, and I don't know if any of y'all have ever been to a counselor or anything like that, but I don't know what they do there, but I'm gonna tell you what they do here. And she gave me this intake sheet to fill out. And it had questions on it like this. Have you ever drank more than 2 or 3 drinks at a time? Have you ever taken illegal drugs? Have you ever abused prescription drugs? Have you ever had more than one sexual partner at a time? Have you ever dressed promiscuously? Have you ever put yourself in dangerous situations? I am checking no as fast as I can check no on this form, thinking, who comes in here? What is this about? I just need a little relationship advice. What is this? I mean, seriously, no clue. And she looks at that form and she looks at me and she goes, well, looks like the only thing sick about you is that you're dating Cliff Gooding. Let's talk about that. And that's what she said to me. And I'm going to tell you what I heard. See, it's him. It's not you. He's the problem, not you. And I'm going to tell you, I went on to counseling on that basis, that he was the problem. And I continued counseling on the basis that he was the problem. And so we go to counseling for a while. He has convinced her that he is bipolar, which I didn't know anything about. But the episodes that are described in the physician's manual kind of described him. High, lows, lows. And he's, you know, has these manic episodes. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's got a mental illness. That's what this is. And so she prescribes drugs for that and he takes them and things kind of mellow out for a while and then they get crazy again. And then everything is now blamed on the medication and this diagnosis. And so when he can't sleep, it's because of the medication. When he can't eat, it's because of the medication. When he sleeps too much, it's because I forgot to take my medication. I didn't take the right amount. I took the wrong kind. They're going to change it. I mean, everything. And it is a roller coaster ride and it is continuing and I am crazy. And I'm still trying to fix him. I'm still trying to get him to do what I think he should do and act the way that I think he should act. And he is not playing the part. I just want you to know. And so one day we've been going to this counselor for 2 years. And finally, I think she just done all she could do for us or was just sick of us. I'm not really sure which. And she sent us somewhere else. And this lady that she sent us to had him figured out in like 3 visits. What I know now that I didn't know then is that she was a member of Al-Anon. And she had him figured out. And so we go in and she's like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write you a prescription for tranquilizers. I want you to give him one at 6. If he's not in bed by 10, I want you to give him another one. And then you go to bed. And so I did that. And the next morning I got up and he was not in bed with me, which by this time is not an uncommon occurrence. And by the way, I also got married in this time, just so you'll know we're now married. And he's not in bed with me. And I get up and usually he's asleep on the couch or in our spare bedroom on the other side of the house. And on this particular occasion, I got up and he was in the guest room. And I went to open the door and it had been barricaded shut by a love seat. That had not happened before. And the other door going in from the bathroom, it was locked. And if you're an untreated Al-Anon of my type, you will know that a love seat is no barrier for people like us. We can get in anywhere if there's a drunk in there. That's the truth. We can find you anywhere. We will get you out. If you were in Fort Knox, we could find you and get you out. That's just the truth. We have this innate ability, I believe, to seek and find anybody. I just think that it's just a gift. I really do. I'm still convinced to this day, had you told a bunch of Al-Anons that Osama bin Laden was a drunk and that his family needed him at home, there would have been no need for military action. We would have had him in no time at all because we are gifted with that. And so I break in on him. He is naked to the world. He has passed out. And on the side of the bed, on the floor, is an empty bottle of wine and an empty bottle of vodka. And up next to the adult videotapes that had ran out that he had pulled up, the TV up to the side of the bed, was a little clear package with some white substance in it. And that's how I found out what was going on. And people used to say to me, oh, you were in denial. And I was like, nope, I was just an idiot. I wish I could blame denial. I wish I could tell you that I was in denial, but that is not the case. I just had no idea. Anyway, I hit him as hard as I could hit another human being. And he bolted up out of bed and I shook that package at him. And I said, what the heck is this? Those are not my exact words, but let's just go with that. And he looked at that package and he looked at me and he goes, I don't know. And when he tells the story, he likes to say, I guess those people that barricaded me in here must have dropped it on their way out. But We had another fight, which is not shocking, I'm sure. And I asked him to leave. Now, listen, I'm just going to tell you, let me just say this. I did not know what was going on, but I am going to tell you that I had people that knew me and knew Cliff and found out that we were dating and would call me. And here is generally the conversation that happened almost every single time. They would call me up and they'd say, hey, are you dating Cliff Gooding? And I go, yeah, you know him. And they go, oh yeah. And I'd say, well, tell me about him. And they'd say, well, you know, he's brilliant. He's probably one of the smartest men you ever meet. And I knew that. He did his undergraduate in 3 years and he graduated top 5% of his law class. And he was seventh in his law school. And they'd say, and he's really successful. And I knew that when I met him, he had this huge law firm and he had all these attorneys working for him and staff working for him. So I knew that. And they'd say, and he's a lot of fun. And I knew that because we'd had a lot of fun. I will tell you, we had had a lot of fun. And then they'd say this, they'd say, but he's a liar. He's a cheat. He's arrogant. He's egotistical. You cannot trust him as far as you can throw him. And you need to stay away from him. And that is what they said to me. And what I heard was, he needs you. And so it's not like I didn't have some sort of warning. I just didn't. I just thought I was different. Yeah, I could fix him. I am the solution. And so anyway, I kicked him out of the house. He came back later and I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I live here. And I said, not today, you don't. And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, I want you to go tell Wilma what you've been doing. Now, Wilma is my stepdaughter's mother. And at the time that Cliff and I got together, my son was 4 and his daughter was 5. And at the time, Wilma had about 14 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, you need to go tell her what you've been doing. And he said, okay. And he left and he came back a couple of hours later. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I went and did what you said. I went and told Wilma, she took me to a meeting and I'm going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. Now I'm just going to tell you, I had no idea what he was talking about and I did not care. I just didn't want him in that house. And I told him to leave and he did. And I called Wilma. And I'm going to tell you, I wish I could tell you that I called Wilma because I knew she had 13 or 14 years in AA. And I knew that she was going to, you know, tell me about alcoholism and tell me what I was dealing with. I wish I could tell you that, but that's not what I called Wilma for. I called Wilma to check up on him. I wanted to make sure he wasn't lying to me. And that's why I called. And she said, yeah, he told me. And we went to a meeting and we're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I still had no idea what she was talking about. And I said, well, that's great. What do I do? And she said, would you be willing to go to a meeting with me tomorrow? And I said, yes. Now I'm going to tell you why I said yes. Not because I thought I had a problem. Not because I thought that the meeting was going to give me some sort of answer for all this that was going on. I said yes because I was pretty much out of ideas. I had one idea left that I knew was going to be the answer. And that was, I was going to kill him. And I had planned it. I'm just going to tell you, one of the things that I think is the worst thing that can happen for untreated Al-Anons is for us to watch too many episodes of Forensic Files and 48 Hours Mysteries, because we have planned your death so many times, you have no idea. And we are pretty sure we have learned from those people's mistakes because we're a little smarter than that. And they've made the same mistakes 5,000 times, every single one of them. I'm pretty sure we can figure it out. And I'm pretty sure I have some people that's going to help me. So I had planned on killing him. And so she asked me to go to a meeting and I thought, murder a meeting. I mean, I have a backup plan. I guess a meeting's not going to hurt me. I'll just go see what these people have to say. And I went and she took me to my first meeting and she took me to my second meeting and she took me to my third meeting. And I don't know how you got to your program, but I got here with the ex-wife and I started going to meetings And after 45 days, Cliff relapsed and he came home and I said, you've been drinking. And he's like, no, I haven't. I said, we're going to do a drug test. And he was like, wait a second, you're being a little harsh. And we started another fight and he once again got asked to leave. And once again, I called Wilma and she said, I think we should go get supervised visitation with our kids. And I thought that was a great idea. And I wish I could sit here tonight and tell you that the reason why I thought that that was a great idea is because I wanted to protect my kids. But the truth of the matter is, the reason why I wanted to do that is because I wanted to punish him. You drink at me, I'll show you, buddy. And that's how I did. And I went to go meet this attorney and she asked me, by the way, who was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, coincidentally. And she asked me, she said, do you want a divorce? And I said, no. And she said, what do you want? And I said, I just want him to be okay. And she said, well, if that's true, if that's really true, then you need to decide what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And you need to be very matter of fact about that. You need to really know. And she said, and when you know what you want to do and what you're not willing to do, you need to go tell him. And when you go tell him, you don't say anything you don't mean. And you mean everything that you say. We don't do threats. And so I said, okay. And she said, but listen, when you go to talk to him, when you decide what it is and you go talk to him, you need to be really calm. Now I'm just going to tell you, there are 1,000 adjectives that can describe me. Calm ain't making the list. I've never been calm in my life. Nobody's told me ever to this day has ever come up to me and said, you know what I like about you, Lori? You're just so calm. I don't even know what calm is. I've never seen calm in my life. I thrive on chaos and calamity. I'm just telling you, that's where I live. I don't know calm, but I've been going to Al-Anon for 45 days. And the one thing I knew was a serenity prayer. And at this time, Cliff had not worked in 3 years, and I had been supporting us. I had a really good job and had been supporting us for the last 3 years. And one of my job, and on my job, I drove a lot. I was in sales and I drove a lot to meet clients and stuff. And on that particular day, all I did is I drove around and I said the serenity prayer. And I said it 500 times, and that is not an exaggeration. I'm telling you, that's all I did. And I called him and I asked him to meet me at home. And when he came home, or when I got home, he was here, and I grabbed his arm or grabbed his hands. And I said to him, I know that you have a problem, and I know that this must be hard, and I know you must be scared, and I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. And if I need to go to meetings or counseling or treatment or whatever I got to do my part, I'm going to do that. But only if you can do your part. And if you can't do that, I can't stay. And you know, when I said that, it was the first time in my whole life I felt okay. It was the first time I was comfortable in my own skin. Up until that point, I'd never been good enough. I'd never been smart enough. I'd never been pretty enough. And I'd never been okay on my own. I've always had to have him. I've always had to have a him. And I've never been okay on my own. And I knew at that time, for the first time in my life, I knew that no matter what he said, I was going to be okay. I knew it in my soul, in my gut, in my heart. I knew that it was going to be okay. I knew if he said, screw you, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And if you don't like it, go. I knew it was going to be okay. I knew I could do it. But that's not what he said. He said, you're right. I do have a problem and I am scared. And he also told me that he wasn't bipolar and that he didn't have a sleeping disorder, which I kind of figured out by then, but it was nice for the verification. It was sweet of him to let me know. And then I said, well, what are you going to do different? Because all I knew is that he was going to meetings. And I thought that was the answer. You're going to meetings. And he said, I'm going to ask a guy to sponsor me tomorrow that I know is going to hold me accountable. And I'm going to do whatever he tells me to do. And I'm going to tell you, the next morning he got up and he asked that man to sponsor him. And he's been doing whatever he's been told to do ever since then. And he's been sober ever since. And that left me with me. And I'm just going to tell you, when the obsession in my life gets better and I'm just going to meetings, I get crazier. I get sicker. And so I'm doing all the things that they tell you not to do in Al-Anon. I'll just let you know, I did everything wrong. I am watching and I am waiting because, by God, he's going to relapse. I'm going to catch him and then I'm going to punish him because that's what I do. So I'm waiting and watching and I'm asking questions. I'm doing all the things they tell you not to do. All of them. Where were you today? How many meetings did you go to? Who did you go with? What did your sponsor say? Was he at the meeting too? Is there anybody else at the meeting? Who do I know that was at the meeting? Where are you going tonight? How many times have you gone to a meeting tonight? How much money did you spend put in the basket? Did you go to lunch today? I gave you $20. How much is left? I mean, I am insane. I am going to meetings and I am sharing this at meetings. It's not like I'm keeping it to myself. I am sharing about this at meetings. And that's why I love the people in Al-Anon, because you people are so nice and patient with all the newcomers for a while. I mean, you really are. We let you guys say whatever. You know, you'll share in a meeting and they go, keep coming back, which means, oh my God, you really need to be here. You are insane is what that means. And so, and they're saying, you know, glad you're here because you don't need to be anywhere else. I mean, we know the lingo now, but when you're new, you just think, oh, they love me. And so, and they put up with us for a long time. And then about, I don't know, a month or two in, I don't know how long it'd been, and I'm still sharing all this stuff. And finally, somebody says to me, do you have a sponsor? And I was like, no, I don't. I probably should get one of those. And let me just tell you something. When I tell you that I did everything wrong, I did everything wrong. When Cliff and I got into a fight, I didn't have a sponsor, so I called his. I'm just telling you, I did everything wrong. I did everything wrong. And then I got a sponsor. And there was a lady that was in these meetings that I absolutely loved. I loved every time she shared. I loved everything that she said. It was like she was talking to my heart. And I was like, oh my God, she knows me. She is me. And so she was so sweet and everybody just loved everything that she said. And so I followed her after a meeting and I said, I really need a sponsor. Do you think you could sponsor me? And she said, yeah, here's my number. Call me tonight. And so I did. So I called her and she said, tell me why you think you need Al-Anon. First thing she said to me, why do you think you need Al-Anon? So I told her everything he had ever done. He did this and he did that and he's this. And then he said this and I went on and on about him. And I don't know if I stopped or paused or if she just finally got in there. I to this day don't know, but she's like, okay, well, now we know he's not the problem. You are. Let's talk about that. And she seemed so nice in this meeting. And now I have Hitler as a sponsor. And she said, and I said, and I'm going to tell you, that's what I thought at first. And then the word sunk in. And I swear to you, it was step one for me because I said, oh my God, I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable by me. You see, he was getting better. He was working with a sponsor. He was taking the steps. He was working with newcomers. He was going to meetings. He was doing all the things that you should do. And I was crazy. My life was unmanageable and it was unmanageable by me. It had absolutely nothing to do with him. Nothing. And I did not know it until she said that to me. And we recognized my powerlessness and my unmanageability in my life. And we went through the steps and then I got to step two. And what you need to know is that when I was a little girl, I grew up in church. My daddy actually started a church. He was not a minister. Do not get me wrong. He was not, but he helped start a church. And I grew up in church and I'd always gone to church. So I believed in God. I did not think that my life was unmanageable because I was paying the bills. I was getting the kids to where they needed to be. I was making sure the house was clean. I was making sure everything was taken care of. Wasn't I managing? But no, I was just juggling balls. I was crazy. Nothing in my life was manageable. I was trying to control everything around me and it was not working out, which was making me crazy, which was making my life unmanageable. And that made me insane in step two. That's what I was getting at, my insanity. And then when she told me the definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results, that hit me like I can't even. Because I can't tell you how many things I have tried to get that man to do and act the way that I thought he should do and act. I have checked emails. I have listened to voicemails. I have searched through cars, through pockets, through drawers. I have followed him. I've looked through parking lots. I've tried to find out where he is. I have done all of that. All of that. I've begged, I've pleaded, I've threatened, I've screamed, I've cried. I've done it all and nothing worked. But every single time that I tried any of those things, every single time, I thought this is the day he's going to hear it. This is the time it's going to work. And that's the insanity of it. And I could not see it. I said that one time in a meeting and one lady came up to me afterwards and she goes, how did you get the password to his phone and his emails? And I was thinking, that's kind of a rookie move. You may not qualify for this program if you can't do that. But anyway, so we started going through and so we got to step three and I'm going to tell you, I grew up in church. Step three, no big deal, right? Hardest step I took, without a doubt, hardest step I took. My sponsor asked me one question when we got to step three, do you trust God? And I said, yes. And she said, no, you don't. And I was like, yes, I do. And she was like, no, you don't. And I was like, why would you say that? She goes, tell me why you think you do. And I go, tell me why you think I don't. And she said, because you've been trying to do his job your whole life. And she was right. And I did not know it. I did not know it. She said, tell me the last time you gave anything to God and let it go. Yeah, I got nothing. The only thing I could come up with is when my son was 3 days old, he had to have open heart surgery. Gave that to God. Had I been a surgeon, probably not. But that's the only time God got anything from me is when I had absolutely nothing, no way to manipulate, fix, control, coerce, to get my way. That's the only time. That's the only time God got anything. And those were few and far between, I will just tell you. And she said, we're going to start practicing trust in God. get ready, get busy on your four step. And that's what I did. I did my four step and I got ready, got it done. And I called her and I said, my four step's ready. She said, great. Be at my house Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. You're going to do your fifth step. And I said, okay. And at that time we were remodeling our kids' rooms. And the only thing left to do in our kids' rooms was to get my daughter bedding. That was it. It was on a Friday. I was at work. It was, I think it was fall break. My husband called me and he said, guess what we did today? And I said, what? He said, we went and got Rachel's bedding. And I'm going to tell you, my first thought was, how dare you? How dare you do that without my approval or my input or have my say in that? How dare you? I didn't say that because I had a sponsor. I just said, okay. And I hung up the phone and I came home that night and I said, show me what you got. And he did. They brought it into the kitchen and they showed me. And I said this to them, you know what? That color doesn't even match our room. And that material is so thin, she's going to tear it up in no time. And you spent way too much money on this. You know, he tried to do a good, nice thing for me and I ripped him to shreds and I did it right in front of his daughter. That's the truth. Next morning I got up and I took that stuff and I threw it in the trunk of my car because I was going to take it back because I know better, because I know better. And I go to do my fifth step and I had not gotten in my fifth step very long before she stopped me and she said, hey, now, is there anything that's on this fifth? She had to go get a drink and she came back and she goes, is there anything that's on this fifth step that you don't, that's not written down that you might want to talk about that's happened? And my first thought was, oh my God, he called her. And I said, yes. And she said, what is it? And I told her about the bedding. And she said, do you know what you did when you did that? And I said, yes. Once again, I had to have my way and I had to be right and I had to be in charge. And she said, no, that's not what you did. She said, when you told her that that color didn't match her room, you told her her opinion didn't matter. And when you told her that material was so thin, she teared up in no time. You let her know that no matter what decision she made for the rest of her life, you would always know better. And when you told her it was too expensive, you told her she wasn't worth it. You see, those are the exact nature of my wrongs. It's not the big stuff that I can see. It's those little things that I do every day to everybody I love. And I never give it a thought, never even notice it. And that's where the damage is caused. And I've been doing that to everybody my whole life because I have the ego and the arrogance to think that I know what's best for everybody because I'm always right. I'm always right. We went through my fifth step and we recognized the exact nature of my wrongs in every relationship with every incident and the way that I treated people my whole life. When I got done, I was both elated and horrified because I was so horrified at the person that I was that I didn't even see. And I was so elated that I didn't have to do that anymore, that there was some solutions in these rooms that I could do and that I could learn and that I didn't have to treat people like that anymore. When I got done, there was not going to be a problem with me being entirely ready. I will just tell you that. I mean, she got me. She sent me home to do 6 and 7. I made my list of character defects. I made sure that I didn't leave anything out. I made sure I was thorough. And I got on my knees and I asked God to remove those character defects. And I started my 8-step list and I started my amends. And I will just tell you, one of the biggest amends I had was to my ex-husband, because when we got a divorce, he did not want a divorce. And he told me, I'm going to make you pay if you leave me. You're going to regret it the day you leave. And he did. He did some underhanded things and he pulled some strings and he did some stuff that he probably shouldn't have done. And he got custody of our little boy. And I thought that was the worst thing that could ever happen. And I was livid about it. And I'd taken him to court several times and I was, and I had gotten that really good job. And I was always throwing money in his face and saying I could take care of our son because you can't even afford to buy him clothes. And I was just awful to him for years. And what I realized by doing that fourth and fifth step, that my son had seen enough horrors on the weekends with his dad and with his stepdad and I fighting, and that it would have been even worse had he been with me full time. He should have been taken away from me. That's the truth. You see, when we had those knockdown, drag out fights, I called my husband names I wouldn't call my worst enemy today. I have said and done things to that man I wouldn't do to another human being, no matter what they've done to me today. And those little kids saw every single bit of that. They were front and center for all of it. So one day I was picking up or dropping off, I can't remember which, and I said, can I talk to you? And I'm sure he was thinking, oh God, what now? And I got out of the car and he got out of his truck and I said, listen, I just need to say something to you. I want to tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you raised Colby and you've done a great job. And I am so glad that you're his dad. And I want to thank you for everything that you've done for him. He turned white. I was pretty sure he's getting ready to pass out. So I left and I got about 5 minutes down the road and he called me and he said, I can't tell you what that means to me. You see, I didn't think I'd done a very good job. I sure as heck didn't think that you thought that. And that means the world to me. And I really appreciate you saying that to me. And somehow after that, he got better. I don't know. And one of the other amends I made was to my mom. And I didn't talk to her for 3 years after I got kicked out of that house. And I hadn't talked to her very much since then. And my sponsor started making me email her every week. And then she made me start calling her every week. And I can't tell you how long that had been, but it had been a couple of years while I was doing that. Every week I either emailed or called her. And I'd been calling her for a while. And one day she brought up how she raised me. And what she said to me was, I can't tell you how many times I've cried myself to sleep for the way that I treated you, the way that I raised you, and the things that I allowed to happen to you. And out of my mouth came, well, Mom, you need to learn to forgive yourself because I've forgiven you a long time ago. And it was the truth. And I can't even tell you when or how that happened. I just can't. And I made the rest of my amends and I got through all those and made amends to my kids and my sisters and my brother. And I did the best that I could. And, you know, I do a 10 step every day. I try to keep my side of the street clean. I will tell you, I still hate being wrong. And I still hate to apologize. The first time that I apologized to my husband, I had to call and leave him a voicemail because he was in court. And he kept that voicemail until that phone died and he would just replay it every once in a while because he never heard it. I'm not kidding. He was so excited that he actually got an apology from me. Every once in a while, he'd say, have you heard this? And he just pressed the button because he was shocked because that's how bad I was at apologizing. I'm just telling you, when I tell you I was never wrong, I hated it. And I still don't like being wrong. I'm just going to tell you, 4 weeks ago, we got some salt and pepper shakers and I filled them up and we went to use them and the salt was in the pepper and the pepper was in the salt. And my husband said to me, oh my gosh, did you fill these up wrong? And I said, I think they just mislabeled them at the store because I still don't like being wrong. Anyway, I love the 11th and 12th step. I could go into that, but prayer and meditation is something that I do every single day. And I cannot start a day without prayer and meditation because you don't want me around if I don't. I'm just telling you, it's not a pretty sight. And so let me just say this. My dad died a month before I got in this program and he never got to see this, but my stepmom did. And my stepmom and I became really close. And at the time that my dad died, I was having dinner at their house every Wednesday night. And after he died, she said, are you still going to come over for dinner on Wednesday night? And I said, of course. And she said, oh, I'm so glad. And I'm thinking it's a free home cooked meal. But I still continued to do that. And about after 5 years, she met this man and his name is Herschel. And she wanted me to meet him. And I met him and he's a sweet guy who's 5'6". I don't know. My stepmom's like 5'11". I don't know. But anyway, he's gorgeous, cute little guy. Loved him to death. Sweet as he could be. Anyway, a couple months later, I said, you know, I didn't think you'd ever get married again, but I could see you marrying Herschel. She said, I could too. And sure enough, a couple months after that, she called me and she said, I need to talk to you. And I said, you're getting married, aren't you? And she said, not if you're not ready. I know how close you were with your daddy and I know how much he means to you. And if this is too much or this is too soon, I can wait. And I said, Mom, don't ever give me that much power again. My daddy would have loved Herschel and he would want you to be happy. And they got married and my stepmom got sick about 5 years after that. And she'd never been sick a day in her life. And I didn't know what was going on. And she had organized pneumonia in her lungs. And she'd been in and out of the hospital from September until January. She just could not catch her breath. And it was just an ongoing thing. And in January she went to the hospital and I went and saw her on Monday night at my home group and Saturday she died and Herschel called me to tell me that she was gone. And I went out to their house the next day and he said, and I don't know why this happened, but this is what happened. And she had insisted on sleeping in her own bed, which was at the top of the stairs. And by the time that she would get up to the top of the stairs, she literally would collapse in bed because she was out of breath. And so Herschel had had a chairlift put in and it had gotten installed the last day before she went to the hospital. And for some reason, I don't know why I asked this. I really don't. This is not something I would normally ask, But it was just Herschel and I, and we were waiting on everybody. And I said, Herschel, how much did that chairlift cost? And he said, I don't know, like $2,700. And I said, and she got to use it one time. And he looked at me without skipping a beat and looked me straight in the eyes and said, it was worth it. And that taught me this: no matter what's been done to me and no matter what pain I've caused other people, if it got me to you, it was worth it. You see, I would not change one second of my life if it was going to cost me being here. This program has given me the God of my understanding that I couldn't get anywhere else. And that God has given me everything. I am the mother that I am today. I am the spouse that I am today. I'm the sister that I am today. I am the person that I am today because of you people in this program and the God of my understanding. And I would not change one thing. I would not change one thing if it was going to cost me being here. My son was in a car wreck when he turned 19, and he totaled his truck, and I got this check from the insurance company. He wanted me to give it to him. And I said, no, I said, I'm not giving you this check. You can go get another vehicle. I'll help you pay for it. I'll give you the money for it. You can have this money, but I'm not giving you the check. And he got mad at me and he left and he wouldn't talk to me. And I was calling him and he would not answer his phone. And I was texting him and he wouldn't text me back. And then I just turned into this person that I was. And it is like I'd never been to an Al-Anon meeting. I was doing stuff like, by God, I paid for this phone. I'll shut it off if you don't call me, buddy. And real spiritual. And finally, I called my sponsor, and she said, okay, here's what we're going to do. Now, listen, let me just say this. That sponsor that I got has been my sponsor this day. Yesterday, she celebrated 42 years in both programs. And so the one thing that I've always done, the only thing that I've ever done right in this program, is that I've done exactly what she's asked me to do every single time. So when I called her and told her what was going on, she goes, okay, here's what we're going to do. And I said, what? She goes, we're going to leave him alone. And I thought that was ridiculous. And I said, did you miss that? It's not Cliff, it's my son. And she's like, no, I got it. Leave him alone. Don't call him and don't text him. You're just going to leave him alone. And so I didn't. 3 months went by. And after 3 months that went by, I was talking to her. She goes, have you heard from Colby? And I said, no. And she said, okay, here's what you can do. You can get a card. And the only thing it can say is, I love you and I miss you, Mom. And I said, okay. And so I got the card. At the time, my sponsee had her best friend's husband worked with my son. And it was our home group night. I gave her the card. I said, can you get this to Colby tomorrow? And she said, sure. Next morning at 10:30, Colby starts blowing up my phone. He starts texting me, Mom, I'm sorry. I was just mad. I really miss you. And I miss Cliff. Do you think we can go to dinner this week? And I was so excited. So I called my sponsee and I said, so you got Colby the card? And she goes, nope, still in my car. And that's how God works in my life. I am supposed to follow directions and get out of the way, and God always takes care of the rest. And why I still forget that to this day is beyond me, is beyond me. I have one more story and then I'm done. When my son was 26 years old, he joined the Army and he didn't tell me. I don't mean that he went to the recruiter's office and signed up and came home and said, hey, I'm joining the Army. I mean, he was in boot camp. And I found out, and I was calling his phone and it was going straight to voicemail, and I was trying to figure out what's going on. And I got on Facebook and I started looking, and I happened to find this group that he was a part of that I was not, that he had messaged and told them that he was going into the Army. I might've been doing some investigating. I'm just saying, I found out. Okay. That's all that matters. And so I called his dad and I said, hey, did Colby join the Army? And he said, yeah. And I said, he didn't tell me. He said, Lori, I told him to tell you. I swear I told him to tell you. I go, I believe you, but he didn't tell me. And I'm going to tell you, I walked around for 2 days thinking, I can't believe he joined the Army and didn't tell me. How dare he join the Army and didn't tell his own mother? And it was like God hit me over the head. I'm not kidding you. And I thought, of course he didn't tell you. Why would he tell you? Every time that he's made a decision in his life that you didn't agree with, you've made sure to let him know. And you've criticized every time he's made a mistake, and you've let him know, you've told him what to do his whole life. He's never made a decision without you criticizing him or telling him it was wrong or whatever. You weren't safe to tell. And sure enough, that's exactly what it was. He sent me a letter I got a couple of days later and said, Mom, I've joined the Army and I'm sorry, but I just didn't want our last talk to be a fight. And I hope that you're not disappointed in me, but if you are, I understand. And I hope you know that I did this for me. And It was the saddest and sweetest letter. It said, if you never want to speak to me again, I understand, but I hope you know that I had to make this decision for me. And I really do think that this was the best thing for me to do. And you know what? I got to writing back and I got to own the fact that I was not a safe person. And I let him know the reason why you couldn't tell me is because I had been critical of you your whole life. And I've always told you what to do and how to do it. And when you didn't agree with me, I criticized you and I was not a safe person. And that is not your fault. That is my fault. And that is how my alcoholism has affected him. And, you know, he called me the next weekend and we talked and I said, is there anything else I need to do or say? And he said, no, Mom, I think we're good. And I'm going to tell you, we've been good ever since. Last week, he called me. He had broken up with his girlfriend and he talked to me for an hour and he asked my advice and wanted to know what I thought. And I didn't have to force it on him. He actually asked, who knew? And he and I are good today. But that was just a deeper amends that I had to make that I didn't know how to do with the first round. It's just how it worked out. There was a couple here named Jack and Hody Mitchell. They were an American Indian couple. Jack died with 42 years of sobriety. Hody died with 36 years of sobriety and was a member of Al-Anon for a long time. And she learned this prayer at an American Indian meeting in Arizona. And she brought it back. And there's some of us that have learned it. And I always close with it. And it goes like this. I've been told the reason we join hands is to remind us of the truth that we are no longer alone. Our prayers for the still suffering in these rooms and on the streets. Hold on to the person's hand next to you like your life depends on it, because someday it may. Thank you for holding my hand and allowing me to hold yours. And thank you for having me here tonight.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you so much.